Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, on this May 6th, 2021. Seems I missed any of the cool jokes I could have done on either May 4th or 5th. But hey, can't change a day that Thursday falls on. As always, thank you for subscribing to Consumer. I really appreciate the feedback I get on the podcast and happy that I'm playing in some of your cars, exercise routines or walks. Or if you're falling asleep to this in the evening, which I guess in a way helps out some of you as well. Thank you for subscribing and keep listening. My guest this week is the Senior Director of Global Policy at Bird. Yes, that's the e-scooter company. We're chatting about e-scooters, what they've done for urban mobility, and what we can improve in terms of regulations. So stay tuned, the interview will play at the end of this episode. Also in this show, we know what the EU's COVID-19 passport will look like. My colleague Maria Chaplier joins me to talk about her new paper on junk food marketing restrictions, and Ireland introduces minimum pricing for alcohol. So let's get started. The European Union, as you know, is introducing a COVID-19 passport. Now, exactly, we can't quite call it passport because it's supposed to be sort of a certificate, and it joins, it joins three factors of authentication for you to be able to travel and to avoid quarantine. So you'll either have a negative COVID-19 PCR test or any of the other tests that are available out there, or you can show that you had COVID before and you have antibodies, or that you've been vaccinated with one of the vaccines recognized by the European Medicines Agency. Now, of course, this is all to save the summer. As they say, a lot of the southern countries are very keen on having travel restrictions loosened and travel restrictions that includes quarantine rules, because if you can only go to a country if you do a 14-day quarantine, that's not really a holiday, unless staying home is your favorite thing to do on a holiday. So this is really supposed to be a solution for this purpose. I am very concerned about this, and I've mentioned this many times on this podcast and elsewhere in articles and on the Consumer Choice radio show with my colleagues, Jarosław Lasowski and David Clement. I think this is a measure that will most certainly be here to stay. It will be used for other purposes as well. I don't think it really belongs in a liberal democracy. And I don't think it's really compatible with the Schengen Agreement. You know, the Schengen Agreement means that you can travel between member states of the European Union without needing to provide identification. Now, you can say, of course, well, you don't have to show a COVID-19 passport, but instead then you'll have to do a 14-day quarantine. But I'm sorry, that's just a travel restriction. You know, before this whole crisis, if somebody had told you that, no, we're not restricting travel. All you have to do is after you arrive, you have to lock yourself in and you're not allowed to go outside for 14 days, you would have been like, well, that's a travel restriction, you know? So really, this is a new travel restriction, and you will be required to show these if you don't want to be locked up. And I think that is contrary to the principles of the Schengen Agreement. We signed this agreement so we can travel within the single market, and we can travel unmolested by border patrols that ask us for our paperwork. Of course, this is not the case if you travel to the UK, which has left the European Union and was never part of Schengen. It also doesn't apply to the Republic of Ireland, but it does apply to a lot of EU member states and also non-EU member states such as Norway. So overall, I don't think this is a good measure because it's here to stay. You know, it's now that we see with the COVID-19 variants that this disease is probably going to be here to stay, and we're going to need more vaccinations on a rolling basis. And I think they will also extend this this new pass to other diseases, and they will say, well, this is so useful to be included with other passport measures, meaning other vaccines that you might need to travel around the world. And I do think that this QR code is going to be necessary not just for travel, but also for concert venues and so on. Because the European Union has said that even though this is specifically for the purpose of avoiding quarantine, states, EU member states, are free to use it for other purposes. So you could be asked to show it to enter a pub or whatever. So if you don't have your paper or you don't have your phone on you, it will be papers, please. And if you cannot provide it, no entry. And I do think that's a very worrying development. Even with all the sunset clauses telling you, well, eventually this will be phased out. Some countries say, well, it will be there until the end of the pandemic, declaration by the World Health Organization. But the European Union has chosen the way of having it for a year and then re-evaluation of the measure 3 months before the deadline. I don't think we will see us getting rid of this COVID passport in a year from now. It hasn't even been introduced yet. Everybody hopes it to be introduced before the month of July before the summer holidays start for many people. And yeah, I'm not a fan of it. Now, we've seen some of the practicalities being revealed. I'm reading here, one app for national authorities will be issued as the Green Certificates, a second wallet app where the certificate can be transferred via a two-factor authentication mechanism. And then there will also be a third validation app allowing authorities to scan the certificate at the borders, for example. So many applications for different uses and different people. Overall, I think the technical difficulties will probably also reveal themselves. There's hardly an EU measure that goes smoothly. We'll see. Next up, my colleague Maria Chapley, a research manager here at the Consumer Choice Center, is joining me to talk about her new paper on junk food marketing restrictions. Maria, you just published a new paper on the question of obesity, and it seems to address things that the EU is trying to do. So give us a sense, what exactly is the EU suggesting to do on the issue of obesity?
Thank you, Bill. Happy to be here. So to start with, last month, there was a debate in the European Parliament regarding the possibility of introducing junk food ad bans, which is very similar to the idea that was being discussed extensively in the UK. For a year, I think, before they dropped it also a few weeks ago. And so the debate was around the possibility of having this union-wide junk food ad ban to restrict marketing of junk foods, which is, so there's no EU-wide definition of what junk food is, but we know that this is food high in salt, sugar, and fat. They would need to specify. There's no regulation saying what exactly junk food ad ban would mean. Member states define it in their specific legislation. Even though some groups of MEPs were pushing for this ban, eventually they compromised on the need to review the existing regulations when it comes to junk foods marketing and advertising. There's a new regulation since 2018 on audiovisual media services, which involves some kinds of codes of conduct for junk food industry in terms of how they advertise it, so that through strict exposure of kids. So when we talk about kids, I think we mean in the existing EU regulation, it means people up to the age of 14. The idea is to sort of take the existing regulation and to potentially expand it or to review it. In 2016, there was lots of discussion on the EU level around this junk food ad ban, and it didn't go through, but there were some voices from the Commission saying we need to restrict marketing and advertising of junk food to kids, but it didn't go through. So I think it's interesting to see what will happen next. In the European Parliament, there's a few weeks ago, there was a launch event of the MEPs for Obesity Interest Group, which works very closely with the WHO, which is not surprising, but in a way concerning, because when we look at justification of parliamentarians of the Commission when it comes to obesity, they usually reference WHO, and WHO is very well known for pushing forwards for sin taxes, for junk food as bans, and for strict regulation as such. So I think there's a lot more to see in this space, and I'm afraid we can see a lot of paternalism coming from the European policymakers.
That's right, and obesity is a problem, and it is a problem for young adults and children. So in your paper, give us a sense of like what alternative solutions that you've explored. What can we do to fight this actual existing problem?
Yes, it is a problem, but so for example, when we look at the data, and especially when we talk about obesity, I think there's a tendency to reduce the problem to nutrition, but policymakers, they overlook the fact that there's also genetics, probably mental health, there's parental responsibility and physical activity at play. And so we need to take all these covariables we need to consider all these covariables to understand why obesity persists in Europe. And in Germany, there was, I think there's only less than 20% of teenagers who are physically active. which is a problem if we take into account that obesity is also a matter of physical activity and exercise. But I was the reason why parental responsibility isn't stressed enough is in a way surprising, because my sister is 12, so she would be sort of in this group of people who are supposedly very much affected by junk food advertising. But in fact, she's not. I was thinking about her behavior, and from time to time, obviously, as a child, she wants to get some junk food, some, I don't know, some Coke, some sugary ice cream and anything. But the fact that my parents are keeping an eye on her nutrition and on her exercise in a way, it's not like she has a problem. She can see this advert on TikTok or somewhere. She doesn't watch TV, obviously, but she's tempted to try it, but she would never keep doing this if my parents don't love it. So one of the solutions is to encourage parental responsibility, of course, which sounds in a way vague, but it's not. It just, we want to empower consumers, adult consumers, and to say, this is your child, you need to take care of their health and nutrition, physical exercise. And as part of this, it would be great if we were also trying to educate kids in school about nutrition, exercise, mental health problems as well too is important in this space. And then one of the solutions I also suggested would be, aside from promoting physical exercise as well, would also be to encourage family meals. So when the family would come together and they would sort of, parents would be able to portray this healthy eating behavior to their kids. And so they see what's normal, what's not normal, and then they can evolve as adults into consumers who are responsible for their health and not tempted to eat some foods that are not healthy for them.
You can find this paper under the publications page of consumerchoicecenter.org. In other news then, the Republic of Ireland is introducing minimum alcohol pricing to combat binge drinking. As Politico reports, and I quote, the law would require retail alcoholic drinks to be priced at a minimum of 10 cents per gram of alcohol. In practice, this means discount beer, currently costing less than 1 euro a can, would have to be priced above 1 euro 35, while bargain basement wine, now selling for less than 4 euros a bottle, would cost a minimum of 7 euros 75. Vodka, currently available for 13 euros a bottle, would cost more than 20 euros. I overall think this is not a good measure, and I've written about this in other jurisdictions where minimum alcohol pricing has already become a reality. This is the case in England and Scotland and Wales, if I'm not mistaken, and the conversation there was always the same. This is there to combat binge drinking, and as far as I'm concerned, I think the binge drinking hasn't quite disappeared. What does appear is black market sales, because if you have these type of taxes, you don't get an alcohol prohibition like we had in the 1930s in the United States, but what you get is a quasi-prohibition. If it's not available to low-income consumers, then they will go and look for it elsewhere on the market. This is just generally a question of supply and demand. You know, if the consumers don't actually got what they're asking for, they will, or at least for the price that they're asking for it, they will find this on the black market, because it can be produced and sold more cheaply. And of course, as you all know, black market booze is very dangerous, so don't buy it. But the problem, of course, is that some consumers will. I mean, we've seen this with black market cigarettes. If you go to the Paris North Station today, you'll find a lot of people offering you to buy cigarettes at a very low price, especially because in France, the price will, I think it is already at 10 euros a pack or something. At least they're getting close to it. This is just very problematic, because consumers find other ways. And I've written about this. Let me just give you an example of something I've written about minimum pricing. While minimum prices try to prevent consumers to pivot to lower quality products, we need to realize that funds are fungible. Nothing prevents consumers to spend less money on healthy food in order to afford their consumption of liquor. History, most notably the prohibition age in the United States, has shown that people are very difficult to keep away from alcohol, no matter what restrictive measures the government puts in place. This is something I think we really need to note, that people want to drink alcohol and they should be free to do so. It's their choice. That doesn't prevent us from having organizations, charities, and educative platforms telling us exactly how to consume it and be better at knowing our limits, drinking water in between drinks at a party, but sometimes allowing people just to be able to have their drink. I mean, I'm sorry, this nanny state, I'm really not a fan of it. By the way, next week we will also be talking more about the nanny state, so stay tuned for that. I think overall, minimum pricing will affect low-income consumers the most. You know, if you're already able to purchase expensive liquors, this will not be a particularly bad increase for you. And I think it's this very paternalistic approach where, what was it? Bloomberg? Yes, Michael Bloomberg said this in the past, you know, that he thinks that poor people are the most affected by these health consequences of certain consumptions. Those should be protected the most. I think it's very patronizing, paternalistic. I don't think it really belongs in an informed consumer society. Informed consumers should be able to make their own choices. But now let's move to the interview of this week. I'm talking to Yaniv Rivlin, the Senior Director of Global Policy at Bird, the e-scooter company. So Yaniv, we are talking about e-scooters, and of course, for the people who haven't been living underground for the last few years, e-scooters are really everywhere. Every major city in Europe, but all around the world have e-scooters. First off, explain to me how this has gotten so popular. What is the actual appeal, in your view, of using an e-scooter in a city?
So I truly believe that using an e-scooter is the most fun, easy, environmentally friendly way to get around. We're seeing more and more congested cities, more and more cars on the roads. Every day it's getting worse. And finding these solutions are a good way for people to avoid the traffic and to also see the city in a better way. You know, Bird is the company that that started the entire scooter sharing industry close to 4 years ago, and you know we've seen it grow tremendously since because. Of that, because of the fact that people really want alternatives. They don't want to be stuck in their car. They don't want to be stuck in traffic. They want to get around, again, in easy, fun, accessible, and environmentally friendly way. And the best way to do that is through scooters. Whoever tried once really falls in love with it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when I used to live in Brussels, I would take it all the time because especially during rush hour, this was the easiest way for me to get around. I mean, it's not great during the rain, and it does rain quite a bit in Brussels. But if you can withstand that, that really works. Just to give our listeners some perspective on like the logistical difficulties, because, you know, when I used to take them, I, you know, needed to find one close by. Can you just shortly explain to what extent this is a complex operation to really run e-scooters that are like available in different parts of a city, but also charged because, you know, I want to get somewhere.
100%. Yeah. Again, the operations are not an easy piece. I know people see, you know, the scooters on the road and say, wow, this is like amazing. It's so easy to put it there. But there's a lot of both algorithms and a lot of operations, how to put the scooters in the right places for you to have them. It's all about, you know, the location in the end. You want to have your scooter when you come out of a meeting. You want to take it home. You want to take it from your house to having the meeting. If we won't give you that opportunity, it won't be a viable and sustainable solution. So we invest a lot in creating the right operations for you to always have your e-scooter when you come. And obviously the maintenance, the accuracy, everything around it. And I think it's amazing to also see when you look at operations how far the industry has come since we started it close to 4 years ago. And it's amazing to see the progression in that and the innovation. And again, when you think about better, but like creating such an incredible transformation in 4 years is not that long of a time. And as we always like to say, we're only getting started.
Absolutely. And you're also dealing with the competition because there are different actors on the market. How have you seen competition influence the quality of the services, the prices? You know, in some cities I have a lot of options, in some cities that it's just one company available. How have you seen that play out in practice?
So in general, I think competition is a good thing. I think, you know, the fact that, again, we started the industry and competitors came after that, that is a good sign that we're doing something good, and that there's a good market for it. And I think every competitor makes you act better, whether it's in your operations and everything. So, but I also, you know, think that that in general, there's a lot of added value to the brand, the way you put forward that you always need to be aware of the riders, what they want. You have to be aware of cities. And first and foremost, cities are our number one customer. You always need to make sure that the cities are in the forefront of your head, because again, we're in the cities. And so we act together in order to create a great sustainable vision. I think that one of our like biggest advantages is the fact that we provide data to cities, and the cities that we work with, we provide them like real-time data that can help them make smarter decisions around their public sphere. Think about it. If you have millions of rides and millions of unique users, and the city knows exactly where people are riding, where people want to get to in a free-floating way, that means even if you see a trend of riders that come, for instance, 5, 10, 20 meters away from your bus stop, which you created, oh, that might make you think maybe the bus stop should be 20 meters away. And there's never been such a great data source for cities to make those decisions around that, around bike lanes. Many, many cities are telling us that they're creating bike lanes and their strategic planning around bike lanes, thanks to the data that we're providing them on a daily basis. And I wouldn't underestimate that. And the way of working, I think, together with cities really differentiates the competitors as well.
Absolutely. And I've also seen that in some cities, the cooperation works well in the sense that I'm also being told as a user what the spots are where I should park and where I shouldn't park. I've seen this before. Is this something that I assume this comes out of the direct communication with the cities? How exactly does that work? Does a city official contact you and say, hey, we have a problem. People are parking over there. It's not responsible. And how do you solve that then?
So we basically have really a direct line with the cities. We're, again, they're our number one customers. We hear them. We want to help. I think the amazing thing about us is that we're a tech company also in the end, right? So we can actually make those changes, whether it's, you know, geofencing, right? The city comes and tells us, like you said, we don't want rides in a certain square because X, Y, Z, we can create that that area, which will be a ride-free zone. Or we have the opportunity to take down a little bit of the mileage in a certain spot of the city. And I think when you look at the landscape, and we talked a little bit about before, about like micromobility, and micromobility as an industry, I think that's one of the, and which is gaining traction and gaining momentum. I think one of the advantages for shared e-scooters is the fact that the city essentially has that partner, as opposed to private e-scooters, which one can go wherever they want. No one can really control them that well. A lot of people play with the knob to increase the kilometers per hour. Here it's different because you have someone to work with in order to make the right regulations, provide the right data, get the insights. So as you mentioned, they can approach us. We sometimes approach them. Also, listen, we saw 1, 2, 3. We think you should do this. And it's a really a two-way stream there in order to make sure That micromobility is getting more and more into cities. It's solving for cities a problem, and our goal is mutual, to take down the amount of cars that are on the road, to provide a more sustainable and easy way for people to get around.
Now, you talked about the good, but then there's also the bad. In some cities, e-scooters are not allowed at all. You know, I'm from Luxembourg, a small country in Europe, and I remember that Bird was trying to deploy in Luxembourg, and then the city resisted and said, this is not acceptable, we don't want this in our city. And sometimes it just doesn't seem to play out. What do you think lacks in information in those places? What are the arguments that you're trying to use to convince these cities that, hey, this is a choice for consumers that should be there?
So I think it's an education process on all levels. Again, I want to take us back 4 years in this game and look how many, looking at perspective, how many cities have opened up. I have no doubt that all cities will have the micromobility option. Look at COVID. Look at the past year. And change cities that were not open up to e-scooters before, such as New York, cities in the UK, have opened up because of that understanding that this is the best way to go. We're not claiming that everything is perfect yet, and it's a education process, but that is definitely the trend in each city that puts it in. We work together in order to make the right way. So I call on all cities. This is the trend of the present and the future. It's something that working together can make your city much more livable. I really see that at the moment, there's not really a lot of cities that haven't embraced it because they understand that the advantages are far more superior than the rest.
And how do you stand on cross-country regulation? Like, sort of, you know, would you say that having an EU regulatory framework for e-mobility is preferable, or would you say it's better for individual jurisdictions to make their own specific local rules? Where do you stand on this issue?
At the moment, again, at the moment, it's local, whether it's countries. Some places have it in the matter of cities. I think it's an evolution, again, of the industry. And again, in an ideal world, it would be one regulation for all the EU, working together to create the right regulations for that. In a global mindset as well, we understand we're not there yet, but I always believe that once you have, you know, one framework, it's easier to and better to adopt it in that way. But again, TBD on where the future will take. And in the interim, you know, we're working on spreading the e-scooter love around.
One last thing, give some consumers and users of e-scooters some outlook. Do you have anything that you say, well, this is where the future is going to take us? I think probably imagining a scooter that flies is probably too futuristic. But what are some tech innovations that you are currently working on where you say, well, we are working on making the user experience even better and trying to improve the mobility situation even more with existing tools?
100%. So again, I think the innovation is here. The innovation is something I always say, like, if you again look at the time frame and how far we've come, looking at like 2025, we literally, like, we saw, like, around, like, you know, the Jetsons when we grew up, and like you said, the innovation is here to put forward. I think it starts as well by the innovation of the e-scooter itself, like our Bird 2s, which are the newest and most advanced e-scooter in the world. They are much safer, much stronger, much more innovative in terms of their geofencing and other things that we have there. And it's innovating really on every single aspect of really the e-scooter, making it more safe, more viable, attracting, you know, having it really take you to that next mile, as we say, and constantly, again, really constantly innovating around many different aspects to make sure that you as a rider will have the best possible experience to get you from point A to point B, while taking, again, cars off the road and making it much more sustainable for all of us.
And that concludes this episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to support this podcast, please visit consumerchoicecenter.org/donate. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz. See you Thursday. You have to learn.